The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit. Now, first, we're joined by a man who is very familiar with choppy waters in life and business. Endo Cunneen has solo sailed around the world, taken on business in post-communism Eastern Europe, and even tried to cross the Atlantic in a rubber dinghy. Most recently, he has moved into the turbulent world of newspapers. Last year, he bought the Sunday Business Post and has promised a very different offering. We caught up with Endo earlier, and I asked him first about that trip across the Atlantic in a rubber dinghy as a young man. A colleague had bet him he wouldn't be able to do it. I first asked him what was the stake in that bet.
It was actually a bottle of whiskey. It was a fellow from Al from Pascagoula, Mississippi. He said, "I bet, Andy, you'll never do that." And, you know, I think coming from the west of Ireland, it's a little bit of the anti-establishment. If somebody said white's black, you'll set out to prove that black is really white. It was just that sort of challenge, you know, the dare. And that's the risk and that's the excitement of business. And so it's led me to what I'm doing now.
Roll forward then a few decades and you fulfil a dream that I think a lot of people fantasise and dream about, circumnavigating the globe.
Again, if you want to go around the world, buy an airline ticket. But I was privileged. I had a 60-foot boat. It was more like the hull of an aeroplane than a boat. It was built of carbon and Kevlar. And I was privileged, but my ambition really was to sail solo around the world, and it didn't quite go as I'd planned, but we did eventually finish.
Yeah, you did. You got stuck. Was it down in New Zealand?
Yeah, I was crossing the international date line, very close to it, halfway between South Island, New Zealand and the Antarctic. And I got caught in a violent set of conditions and I lost my mast. And I'd come through a lot of storms and I was really in trouble.
Were you worried that for yourself?
I was terrified.
For your actual survival,
yeah,
at that stage.
Yeah, you know, it's the highs and the lows. And I went pretty low. I really went very low because, you know, this was my goal and it was a build up. It was a 3-year training preparation, spending my children's inheritance. And I was privileged to have such a boat. So I went through some pretty bad lows, but the highs compensated. To my amazement, Nicola took me back when I came home.
How did Nicola feel about you going, actually, in the first place? How did your family feel? Because it's a hugely risky adventure. It's of your own making. Was she glad to get a bit of a break from you, maybe?
A bit of a break, I think. Which took me back, which is the important thing. You know, I think, you know, when you have a good relationship, you give each other space. And I took a lot of that. But I did actually get a lawyer friend, a solicitor. He outlined a document that I was going to sign, that if I ever wanted to do anything like this again, they could stop me. But, you know, I was privileged. It was a dream come true to sail solo around the world. And I still can't quite believe I've done it. But now it's on to other things.
What did you learn about yourself from that experience?
Well, we learn how insignificant we are. You know, I was talking about the vastness of the ocean. We're just sort of the commas between two exclamation marks. You know, if you think of eternity, and imagining what you cannot imagine. So you realise the ocean is inanimate. It's not against you or not for you. It has anger, it has big storms, it's calm. So you realise the simple things of life that we take for granted. I mean, people are moaning and bitching about everything every day, but actually, we never had it so good, you know. I mean, there's so much life to be lived. And you know, when you come close to the edge and you almost don't live, I think it makes you feel how lucky we all are.
Take me back to your background. You're from the west of Ireland. Did the sailing come from any family connection to the sea?
No, my father had an involvement in boat building and fish farming, but the concept of yachting, as you know it, with the guys with the yellow Wellingtons and Dunleary, you know, it's a different type of world. So, so we wouldn't have grown up with any silver spoons in our mouths. You know, we're a big family, but the sea just fired my imagination.
Yeah, I saw that your family is the same size as my own family, actually, 3 boys, 5 girls. Where did you come in that family?
Very insignificant down the end. I had 5 sisters and you wouldn't get in their ways, you know. But no, I was down at the end of the family.
Big family in the west of Ireland in the 60s. Was there much money around?
No, no. no. I mean, very little. But, you know, we were okay. My father worked too hard and he had a stroke in his 50s and that knocked the family flat a bit. But no, we would have been relatively well off in that community. But, you know, when I look back now, when I look at what people have now in terms of material wealth, it was of its day.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
I'm never interested really in money, but it's business, it's doing things, making things happen. And a byproduct of that is money. When I started off in college, I started off doing engineering, but after the first term, I changed over and I did a BCom degree. It was actually a girl. Engineers are a bit boring, don't ask me about the girl. But and I ended up doing a business degree. But I've always been fascinated by entrepreneurship, business, how that works, how that operates.
You left Ireland like a lot of people. It was the early 90s when you
correct, yeah.
went eastwards.
I went east. I went to Central and Eastern Europe. I went to Czechoslovakia, which then became the Czech Republic, and it's now called Czechia. Had an office in Poland, in Slovakia. So that was extraordinary. I mean, I was there right at the start of these countries after the Iron Curtain came down.
Yeah, it was at that time known as the Wild West of, in business terms, wasn't it? Like it was a sort of a no-holds-barred, anything goes.
Yeah, well, you know, my bank manager put his arm around me and going with those poor, unfortunate suffering in Eastern Europe, you're a great man. Actually, we knew very little. They were very cultured societies, very, very educated, particularly places like the Czech Republic, superb engineers. You know, I think our perception of it was quite a wrong perception. But I got in at a time of change. And when there's change, there's opportunity. And again, it was extraordinary. I was privileged to be in at the start of a country, effectively.
So that would have been the time when all those countries were coming out of the communist era. There was mass privatization going on. Was that where you set your sights?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. Again, if you're in at a time of change, what I looked at proven business formulas that worked in Western Europe, almost like a franchise, you know. So we set up a credit bureau, which was a system for sharing information between banks. We set up a telephone company, pre-deregulation. But I'd go out on a Monday. I would sleep in the office at night time. I'd have a sleeping bag and they'd leave in the evening and they'd come in the following morning and I'd be there, you know. So it had to work. At a young family, it had to work. But that's entrepreneurship, that's business, you know.
But at that particular time, in that particular part of the world, was corruption an issue?
Not for us, because we were at the smaller end of business. You know, had I known now what was going on, it was happening at the mega end, at the big banks. I was a small entrepreneur doing stuff, you know, and I was quite innocent, to tell you the truth, because we'd grown up outside of that. And also because I was in technology business, you know, we just didn't get involved.
You dabbled in the newspaper business while you were in the Czech Republic.
Yeah, well, you know, I did work with the Irish Press and I worked at the Irish Times. I was fascinated by media and, you know, it's an area that I've, you know, written several books and The Journey to the Edge is the book I've just done on the Around the World trip. And when I finished my trip around the world, the Sunday Business Post newspaper was for sale and I didn't plan to do it, but it was just an incredible opportunity. It was a contrarian investment because media, as we all know, is under challenge.
Anybody coming in to buy a newspaper with any prospect of trying to turn a profit on it at this particular point in the media landscape would seem by some to be the definition of madness. I mean, is there an ego?
No, absolutely not.
Does that come into it? Because you see, we had Tony O'Reilly, yeah, he had to have his newspaper, Dennis O'Brien had his newspaper group.
No, first of all, about madness, I have every aspiration to sanity. We've looked around the world, we've looked at Northern Europe, we've looked at how this industry is going. So we've reinvented as the Business Post Media Group. We're investing in journalism. Richie Oakley, probably one of the best journalists and our editors in Ireland. So we're investing massively in content. We're global, you know, and that's the exciting part. We're not hemmed in geographically anymore. We are a global Business Post newspaper brand and we keep print and we believe in print, but really it's a digital first media business, and that's the really exciting part. And yes, it is a significant investment. It is. People would consider it very risky. I don't. I passionately believe in it, and I'm excited. It's a disruptive force on media, and RTE, as you can see, is going through that as well. It's a massive disruption, and you know, in the RTE case, we all passionately believe in public service broadcasting. It has a role, but the whole media landscape needs to be redefined. It'll either be defined by the media itself or by economics, and separating out public service broadcasting from commercial broadcasting. And we have big challenges ahead in all of media, but it all comes down to good journalism, independent journalism, and content.
Just, I'll come back to the Business Post. Just what you're saying there about RT, like, what would you do if you were
talking about RT,
the DG?
Well, I think they're in a tremendous dilemma because it's the shareholder. You know, it's owned by the people, but you know, you can't be two things. You cannot be a commercial operator and compete with people like us, who don't get any taxpayer support. We don't want taxpayer support. We're defined by our trusted independence. We stand or fall on the content of the Business Post every week. We get no support from the state, nor do we want support from the state.
Why wouldn't you want support from the state, though? If there was, say, a fund for public
service media. No,
we're a business. Media.
We're a business. If we provide quality content, you know, the strength of the Business Post is that if you're in business, you have to get it.
Let's go back to your own media operation. Is it your own? What percentage of it do you actually own?
Well, at the moment, 100%. My model in business up to this point has to be in a smaller part of something bigger. And but I have some friends who have loaned money in, and we're creating a new structure, which is the Business Post Media Group. So when those loans are converted, I will beneficially own in the region of 75% of the business.
So the talk around town that you might be fronting for other investors, and Herity's name has been mentioned.
Actually, you know, in Prague, I meet my Russian minders. And, you know, but they obviously report into Moscow, and one of them has a football team. You know, that's all gobbledygook. I'm spending my children's inheritance. You know, I believe in media. I mean, that's just guff, you know, and just
how
that's
much,
the way it is.
How much did you spend?
More than I'll admit. It's significant.
We've heard the figure 1 million euro.
Well, no, that's an investment in buying the business, but it's not that. It's what we're spending to, you know, on Sunday, it's the Business Post is still coming out every Sunday. We've made a massive investment in technology. We're now a year into the business. It's working. The Business Post is working. It's not so much about money. It's about content. Our greatest asset is the people, the team who produce that.
But you have to monetize the content. I mean, what's your circulation at the moment?
The circulation is at about 25,000, 26,000. It had been about 30,000, and it's been challenged, but we're actually holding our own. The media is going down, but our digital subscriber has grown. We've got 5,000 people now, and they each pay 20 euros a month. And that's grown 35% in the last 12 months. We will keep the print. Every Sunday it has a future. But the digital subscription, we probably have the most aggressive paywall. But that allows us not just to be Ireland, that allows us to be global. The New York Times have 4 million digital subscribers. The Financial Times have 1 million. There's no reason why we can't have at least 100,000. It's going to take us a few years. So that's the opportunity.
Your target is to go from 5,000 digital subscribers to 100,000.
Why not? I mean, it's the world, you know. What's the population of the world? Think of the people in Shanghai, in Bombay. They want to improve their English, you know. If the New York Times can sell that around the world, we have the talent, we have the ability in Ireland.
But do we have stories of global significance that will be of interest to even a member of the Irish diaspora in Shanghai or in Chicago?
We have local stories and you have global stories. Do you see what I'm saying? So where the global stories come from, you know, they can be curated here.
But I mean, if say China is one of the big markets. Would you hire a journalist in China? Because, I mean, New York Times has an extraordinary stable of bureaus right around the world. Is that what you're looking at
for
the future?
No, there isn't time here to go into the full business plan, but we've mapped out a vision of where we want to be. It's like me sailing around the world or sailing across the Atlantic. You set a course of where you want to go. If you get a wind shift, you might change course. You know, we're at the first stage. You know, the next 6 months or a year as the only Irish business paper or the only Irish newspaper in Ireland. And I'm emphasising that. And I've great respect for the imported papers. You know, the foreign papers who put local content.
Well, you say the imported papers, to be fair, the Sunday Times has a very significant presence here.
We're going to
Irish journalists.
To do it better. You know what I mean?
You've lost some of your very high-profile journalists.
We have. But actually, you know, what's happened is we're at a time of change. We've actually increased the number of journalists. We've increased the number of staff since we've taken over, and it's a free market and people want to compete and set up their own business. And that's great because a rising tide rides all. And, you know, it's a market and people, you know, our greatest asset is our people. And if people want to work elsewhere, that's their freedom, if you see what I'm saying.
And you mentioned Richard Oakley, your editor, who is, of course, a brilliant, well-known journalist and editor, and Susan Mitchell, fantastic.
Susan, she's probably
fantastic,
most highly regarded health correspondent.
Absolutely. But now this is the first time your editorial team hasn't been led, or the editorial team of that newspaper hasn't been led by an editor with a business background. I'm wondering, are you taking the paper into a more general...
No, that's a bit unfair. I mean, Richie's
that's not a criticism.
Richie's knowledge of business is very, very strong.
I'm not being disrespectful or critical at all. I'm just saying that in terms of the direction of the newspaper,
you're locked
editorially.
In the bubble of Dublin journalism. We believe in journalism. But our success is in getting out to enterprises, business. We've just did a feature on Shannon, Galway, and that's the message. We need a vibrant, independent media in Ireland.
Okay, but just to be clear, what the question regarding Richard Oakley and Susan Mitchell as your top editorial leading team? I'm just wondering, are you broadening out from the business focus to a more broad editorial focus?
Well, the Business Post has always been about opinion and politics, and we're partnering for some sports coverage as well. So, yes, we are broadening out. We've also taken over Irish Tatler magazine, which goes back 130 years. We've taken over Food and Wine magazine. We've taken over Auto Ireland. We also have Hospitality Expo, a major hospitality exhibition. So we're running a lot of... We've developed this new concept in journalism, which is Business Post Journalism Live. It's the same skill set that does a conference, does an event, does an exhibition, does a podcast, does a video, does the print publication. So we think we are leading the way with Business Post Journalism Live.
I'm just listening to that list of acquisitions and plans there. Have you found a magic money tree somewhere in them?
No, there's look at it's my children's inheritance. I believe in it. But
Do your children feel about you blowing their inheritance operation?
I've lived outside of Ireland. I'm, you know, going to move my base back here. No, there's not a magic money tree. This business has to work.
You must have been very relieved that the paper won the libel case again, that Dennis O'Brien. It was a very high profile libel case, very high stakes, some would have said, to defend it, because not a lot of newspapers defend libel cases now.
It was very high stakes, and I think it's a credit to, you know, Tom Lyons and Ian Keogh. It wasn't on our watch, but we inherited it. And
did you support them? Were you in court for it?
We supported them. It wasn't on our watch. It was the previous owners. We supported them massively in the case. But
in what way?
Well, first of all, time and money, and secondly, when you examine the libel laws in Ireland, they are absolutely ridiculous. it was a risk we took when we took over the business, and it's come through, and I think it's been a tremendous victory for journalism. Now, I have no business relationship with Dennis O'Brien, but I admire him incredibly in what he has done in business.
Would you be friendly with them socially?
I would be friendly with him. I'd be friendly with everybody I meet. It's that we're in the communications business. Our business is to get on with people. Do you see what I'm saying? You know, people were also trying to imply all sorts of connectivity. There's not.
Were you tempted to settle it, though? Because, I mean, it was, if you had lost that, it could have sank you before you, you know, would have pulled you before the below the waterline, as you were just about to set sail, to use a sailing metaphor.
It's very sensitive ground to start getting into the personalities there. You know, it was a risk we took in taking over the business. Did
you attempt to settle it?
Well, I didn't, but our people connected us with us did, yes.
And would you have rathered it was settled before you went to court?
I'll be honest, yes, because it was just such a massive risk. But it was the belief. It was the belief of the journalist. And in retrospect, I didn't realise the significance at the time. But it was particularly important for journalism, for independent journalism in Ireland, to stand up to that.
Is it worrying that you didn't understand the significance of that and that you would have settled? Because it was clear from the demeanour of the journalist in the witness box, it was very well reported, that they felt very strongly that this was a line that they had to stand by.
And the business stood massively behind it.
You tried to settle?
No, that's from a practical business viewpoint. You know, if your livelihood is at stake and you're looking at risk, I mean, it was a massive risk. And, you know, there was a good chance that it wouldn't be in business. So I don't think it's irrational to try and take a practical solution. You know, it highlighted the importance that journalists don't need to be part of the establishment. They need to be slightly outside of the system. They need to ask questions. And it's well documented that school teachers and journalists are the two most difficult people to manage. We don't manage them. We have custodians of an independent brand, and its business, its value system, it doesn't survive if it doesn't have trusted independent journalism.
Speaking about trusted independent journalism, and speaking about Dennis O'Brien, he was criticised by his former editor at the Sunday Independent, Anne Harris, for attempted editorial interference. How would you feel if the Business Post were about to run an unflattering piece about you or somebody close to you or your business?
Bring it on. Do you know what I mean? Provided it's true.
And if a business associate came to you and said, I want them to pull, they're going to run this story, they've been on to me, I don't want to see this in the paper on Sunday.
No, look, at as a publisher, we hire professionals to do their job, and they get on with doing their job. We're not reinventing the wheel here. This just is in Ireland. This is in media all around the world. And if you hire professionals to do their job, and we think we have the best editor in Ireland in Richie Oakley, we're standing massively behind him. We are primarily running a business servicing the needs of the market, and we stand and fall on that. And the value system of that business are the independence and the integrity of the product.
And that was Endo Cunneen speaking to us earlier. And of course, Dennis O'Brien has always denied any editorial interference.